I'm going to begin my sermon this morning with a couple of confessions. First, I wrote this sermon, an Earth Day sermon no less, in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, the headquarters of the Presbyterian Church USA are in Louisville, so it might seem normal for a Presbyterian pastor to visit Louisville from time to time. But here's why I need to confess this sin to you. The only way to get from San Jose to Louisville and back in less than a week is to fly in an airplane. And airplanes deposit an awful lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and thereby contribute to global warming in a bad way. So I'm feeling the need to acknowledge the irony of writing an Earth Day sermon while on a 3-day trip to Kentucky, especially since I was in Louisville for a meeting with my publishers at the headquarters of the Presbyterian Church, and that meeting, for all it cost and jet fuel, lasted 2 hours. Mea maxima culpa. But here's my second confession. I am the John McCain of Bibles. John McCain famously, you may remember this, he famously couldn't recall how many homes he owned. And I don't know how many Bibles I own, though I suspect I own more Bibles than John McCain owns houses, if that's possible. I don't own a lot of Bibles because I'm a Bible thumper. I'm really not. I am well trained in modern scholarly reading of the Bible, and I have often been accused of having what some people call a low view of Scripture, and I've watched with great sadness in my former congregations as members of those churches have walked out of the door never to return because of the way I read the Bible. And yet, this week I counted 18 Bibles on my study shelves. But no, that includes my Twible. I don't know if you know about the Twible, but a Twible is a book that a friend of mine, she actually was my former editor, Jana Reese, she wrote a Bible, she tweeted every book in the Bible. So every book of the Bible, every chapter rather of the Bible is tweeted in a Twitter-linked tweet. It's a wonderful book, you should read it. I don't know if it counts as a Bible or not. So I either have 17 or 18 Bibles on my study shelves, and I've got 4 or 5 Bibles at home, maybe 6. One has is an old Bible with Gustave Doré etchings, and one has woodcut prints by Barry Mosher. Now, I can justify every single Bible I own. I have need for each of my Bibles. Some are beautiful. Some have sentimental value. And I'm interested in the various ways different people have translated the Bible, especially how they've translated the difficult and controversial passages. I even have a large print Bible up here for lay readers who need it. I need it. But I'd be dishonest with you if I didn't admit that one of the reasons I have so many Bibles is that I'm superstitious. I'm not proud of it, but I have a deep, almost primordial belief that Bibles are imbued with the kind of holiness that I want in my life. And it makes me feel a little silly to admit this superstition to you, but as I was practicing my sermon this morning, my daughter Mimi pointed out that really I have been rewarded for my superstition, and here's why. A couple years ago, my car was stolen right out of the church parking lot, broad daylight, while I was inside working, and it was returned shortly thereafter. And the theory that the police officer had for the reason my car was returned is that the thief saw the Bible in my car, realized that he or she had taken the pastor's car and didn't want to go to hell. So, sometimes it pays to be just a little bit superstitious. To believe that a physical book can convey something of God's essence is part of the burden, or maybe it's the blessing, I don't know. But it's natural to those of us who are members of Abrahamic faiths, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. We love our holy books. Even if we don't read them, even if our knowledge of what's between the covers of the Bible or the Torah or the Quran, even if that's just based on rumor or speculation, still, we take our most solemn oaths upon our holy books. And some of us get quite offended when someone desecrates or even disrespects our version of Holy Writ. And there are any number of reasons for this attachment to printed ink on paper. Many of us believe that holy books make a record of God's most precious communications and self-revelations. But I think I think our attachment to the physical books, rather than the meaning of what's written in those books, I think our attachment harkens back to a time when books were rare. You see, during the formative years of the Abrahamic faiths, Torahs, Bibles, Qurans, they were hard to come by. Nowadays, if you lose a Bible, it's not a tragedy. The Gideons will bring you another one. Or you can steal one from the pew rack at church. But Bibles weren't so readily available in years past. They were hand-copied until the invention of movable type 600 years ago. But even then, most people still really couldn't afford a Bible. Bibles were too expensive for most people until the invention of wood pulp paper and of offset printing in the 19th century. And the erstwhile rarity of Bibles, I think, is at least in part why so many people treat holy books with such respect. Now, why am I talking about Bibles on Earth Day? I'm glad you asked. I believe that the Earth, and indeed all of creation, is a sacred text. By observing, by reading the Earth, we encounter the living God out of whose mind all creation took shape. God communicates God's self in nature, just as God communicates God's self in the words found in holy books. But unlike holy books, there is only one earth. If scarcity caused us to revere Bibles and Torahs and Qurans, how much more should we honor and protect the earth? Now, I realize there are many congregations in which a pastor might get fired for proposing a comparison between creation and the Bible, for suggesting anything like an equality between the two. I also know that Montclair Presbyterian Church is not such a congregation. Bless you for that. But just in case anyone among the theology police should listen to this sermon online and might be tempted to file a complaint of heresy against me, I should point out that what I'm saying is really what the Bible said in the passage that Dave read to us. And it's also, if that's not good enough, let me tell you how very Calvinist I'm being here. John Calvin started his magnum opus, his Institutes of the Christian Religion, by writing about how humans can know God. And the first way, according to Calvin, that humans can know God is by learning about ourselves. Now, this might come as something of a surprise to you who are psychologists and therapists, but what you do is a kind of theology, at least according to the Presbyterian or Calvinist tradition, because you're studying the human mind and therefore you are meeting God. But the second way humans can know God, according to Calvin, is by observing God in creation, in the natural world. And it's only then, after exhorting his readers to find God through self-evaluation, and by observing God in creation, it's only then that Calvin starts to talk about the Bible. Now, that's not to say that the Bible was unimportant to Calvin. The Bible was very important to Calvin. But Calvin encouraged his followers to love the created world, to observe creation, and to use it as a sacred text, and to learn from it. Calvin wrote, "It is obvious that in seeking God, the most direct path and the fittest method is not to attempt with presumptuous curiosity to pry into God's essence, which is rather to be adored than minutely discussed, but rather to contemplate God and God's works by which God draws near to us." I hope you will listen to the wisdom of this largely forgotten bit of our Presbyterian heritage. I hope you will look for God and learn about God in the world that is all around us. And having met God and learned of God in the sacred text that is our world, I hope you will be inspired forever to cherish and revere the earth and to do all that you can to care for it and to preserve it. And by the way, you don't have to be a biologist or a geologist to observe God and the earth in all of its fullness. And you don't have to be an astronomer to understand the speech that calls forth from the night sky. Just be human. Be curious. Be capable of wonder. Be susceptible to awe. And be given to fits of joy. When God speaks in creation, don't just be informed, Be delighted. Let the tender petals of a flower overpower you. Let the mountains speak gently to you. Dance when you hear the music of wind blowing through the forest or the rhythm of waves pounding on the beach. Go out into your garden. Dig in the dirt. Plant vegetables. And when the seeds have drawn life and flavor from the soil, go into your kitchens and cook. Set a table and share a meal with loved ones. Let the God revealed in creation strengthen your fellowship and nourish your body. And then remember, if the sacred text of creation is destroyed, we can't go buy a new one. There are no monks copying earth on parchment. There is no movable type, no offset printing, no photocopiers, no electronic files with which to reproduce the earth or pass it on to future generations. We only have one copy of God's self-revelation in nature. So let's do our part to make sure it is preserved. Now, at the start of this sermon, I mentioned that I wrote these words while in Kentucky. And since I was in Kentucky, it seemed appropriate to end the sermon with a poem that, like this sermon, was written in the Bluegrass State. The poet of this, the writer of this poem is Wendell Berry, and the poem is called The Satisfactions of the Mad Farmer. I like the poem because it speaks of the joy and delight we may encounter when we read creation as sacred text. And it's a long poem, so I'm going to read excerpts from it. If you're interested in knowing the whole poem, stop by my study and I'll give you a copy. Here's the poem. The Satisfactions of the Mad Farmer by Wendell Berry. Growing weather, enough rain, the cows udder tight with milk, the peach tree bent with its yield, the honey golden in the white comb, the pastures deep in clover and grass, enough and more than enough. The ground new worked, moist and yielding underfoot, the feet comfortable in it as roots. The early garden, potatoes, onions, peas, lettuce, spinach, cabbage, carrots, radishes making their straight rows with green before the trees are leafed. Raspberries ripe and heavy amid their foliage, currants shining red in clusters amid their foliage. Strawberries red and ripe with the white flowers still on the vines, picked with dew on them before breakfast. Grape clusters heavy under broad leaves, powdery bloom on black fruit with sweetness. An ancient delight delighting. Deer tracks in the wet path, the deer sprung from them, then gone on. Live streams, live shiftings of the sun in the summer woods. The great hollow-trunked beech, a landmark I love to return to, its leaves gold-lit on the silver branches in the fall, blown down after 100 years of standing, a footbridge over the stream. The quiet in the woods of a summer morning, the voice of a peewee passing through it like a tight silver wire. A little clearing among the cedars, white clover and wild strawberries beneath an opening to the sky. Heavenly, I thought it, so perfect had I foreseen it, I would have desired it no less than it deserves. Fox tracks in the snow, the impact of lightness upon lightness, unendingly silent. What I know of the Spirit is astir in the world. The God I have always expected to appear at the wood's edge beckoning, I have always expected to be a great relisher of this world, its good grown immortal in his mind. Amen.